We continue the Shiur in Gemara. The Gemara brings the Pasuk, sentence in Navi, which says, these are the Giborim, that means powerful people, but the Gemara refers us to this, these are the powerful acts of Shiur David, relating to King David, Yoshev, the Shevet, Tachkemoni, who sat in wisdom, Rosh HaShalishi, the head of the great three, Hu Adino HaAtzani, he is the soft, hard one, Al Shmona Meot Chalal, over 800 dead bodies. That's what the Pasuk says in Navi, and the Gemara is going to explain it now. Pamachat, 800 dead bodies at one time. Yemeneh says, the meaning of it is this. These are the powerful acts of King David, the greatness of King David. Yoshev b'shevet. He sat, meaning that he had a rabbi whose name was Ida Hayairi, the rabbi of King David. This rabbi taught King David and taught the other great rabbis at that time. And this rabbi would sit on soft seat, high cushions, pillows. When his rabbi passed away, King David then became the chief rabbi, and in his humbleness, his modesty, he removed all these pillows and sat on the ground in order to learn and teach Torah. This was the humbleness of King David. For this, Tachkemuni, wisdom, Hashem said to King David, for this I bless you, that you will be like me. Because you humbled yourself, you'll be like me. Just as when I issue a decree, it must be fulfilled, that's how you will be the same manner. You will issue a decree, heaven will be, kaviyachol, forced to fulfill your decree. The next statement is, Rosh HaShalishi, the head of the great three, you will be the head over the great three, the three fathers of the Jews. This refers to a story where after Mashiach comes, there'll be a feast, and at this feast, all the leaders of the Jews will be there, fathers of the Jews, Moshe Rabbeinu, and Yeshua. And the law is that the greatest one at a feast is the one that's supposed to say Birkat HaMazon, takes the cup of blessing. Here Hashem talking, David, at this great feast, you will be considered the head. You'll be given the cup of blessing over the great three, the three fathers of the Jews. Now the next two words, Adina HaAtzani, the Gemara says this refers to two separate cases. The nature, the character of King David was such that he could be the softest person in the world, the mildest, and the hottest person. He had these two separate characteristics. When he sat and studied Torah, he was Adino, it means he was mild, pliable, flexible, like a worm. Just as a worm can do contortions, that's how King David acted like a worm. The words of King David in Tehillim, he said, Anochi tola'at v'lo ish. I am a worm and not a person. That's how humble he was. His anivut, his modesty was so great, he said that I am next to any person, I am a worm. So though he was a chief rabbi, still when he came a chance for somebody to state any item, any bit of knowledge from Torah, he lowered himself to listen to that person no matter who the person was. This was during the time of learning Torah. He was that soft and pliable. But when he came to battle, to war, then he became hard as a board. Atzani comes to the word itz, wood, like a tree. He became hard as a board. And in battle, he had this power where he would shoot one arrow with such tremendous force that this one arrow would propel itself through 800 of the enemy at one time. He'd kill 800 soldiers with this one single arrow. And about this, King David cried. He sighed and cried about the fact that 200 were missing. He did not complete the blessing of the Torah. Hashem says in the Torah that when the Jews will fulfill my commands, when they'll be loyal to me, I bless them, that one Jew will be able to kill 1,000 of the enemy. And the fact that he killed only 800 in one time, he cried over the missing 200. And when he cried, a voice came from heaven and said, "This is only because of Uriah. Because you killed Uriah. You had Uriah killed in battle." Uriah, the first husband of Bathsheba, the wife of King David. As we mentioned many times, Uriah divorced Bathsheba. So King David married her completely legally. Plus the fact that Uriah should never have married her in the first place. He was so destined that she was the Zivud of King David originally. For certain reasons, it says that she had to fall into the hands of Uriah first. But when he did take Bathsheba for a wife, and when Uriah was called before him and he punished him, Uriah committed another crime of rebellion against the king, disrespect. He punished him by sending him out into the battle against the country of Ammon, who were idol worshippers. There was no crime on the part of King David in killing Uriah. That was perfectly legal because of the fact that one who rebels against the king, the penalty is death. So that if Uriah committed a crime against King David, he deserved a death penalty. So again, the Zohar Kadosh says, Hashem said King David had no crime marrying Bathsheba, no crime in killing Uriah, her first husband. What was this wrong over which the voice came from heaven and said, "You missed out on 200 soldiers of the enemy. This miracle of killing 1,000 at a time, you killed only 800 because of the crime of Uriah, because he sent Uriah to battle against the country of Ammon, to be killed by Ammon. Had King David killed him himself, it would have been fine. But he sent him to be killed by Ammon, and the Ammonites had swords which were carved out the pictures of their idols. To have this Jew killed by a sword which had the picture of the idol on it, for this, King David was punished, that the blessing of Hashem in the Torah was not fulfilled for him completely. He killed only 800 at a time instead of 1,000. The Gemara says that on Chol HaMoed, that's the intermediate days between the first and the last days of the holiday, there is a law that Chol HaMoed is very strict when it comes to being dressed with holiday clothes. It is so strict that the Gemara says a person could actually lose Gen Eden if he shows disrespect for Chol HaMoed. He minimizes the holiness of Chol HaMoed by saying it's a regular weekday. This is considered a disrespect to Hashem to the point where it's the equivalent of idol worship, the equivalent of breaking Shabbat or the holiday itself. However, there are certain items that are forbidden on Chol HaMoed, certain types of work where it's the same as holidays. You cannot wash clothes, for example. You cannot work in the field. You cannot do certain types of acts because Chol HaMoed is a holy day. So, for example, you're not allowed to paint. The Gemara says, what about painting, human painting? In other words, what about a woman using makeup on Chol HaMoed? The Gemara says that this is allowed because for a woman to use makeup on Chol HaMoed, this is the same kavod as a person getting dressed in his best finery. women may use makeup on Chol HaMoed. Rabbi Yehuda says that Rav Chisda had a daughter-in-law, a young woman, and she was together with Rav Chisda's wife on Chol HaMoed, and Rav Chisda's wife was putting on makeup in front of his daughter-in-law. She was helping her with it. Rav Chisda had a student who asked Rav Chisda, isn't this breaking the holiday? When the Gemara tells us that a woman may put on makeup on Chol HaMoed, doesn't this refer only to a young woman who needs it? For her it's finery. Where does an old woman come to be putting on makeup? What does she need the makeup for? You can't become young again with makeup. For her it's not considered finery, she can get along without it. Rav Chisda said, let me teach you something about women. This, and he used the word heaven, testifies to this fact. That your mother, he said, and your mother's mother, your grandmother, and even if you have one older than that, who is at the foot of the grave, about to go to her grave, they too may put on makeup on Chol HaMoed. Because in this respect, women are vain. They cannot live without makeup. To them, makeup is as important as clothing, and more so. There is no difference between a woman 6 or 60. So therefore, when we say that makeup is permissible for women on Chol HaMoed, this refers to women of all ages. We cannot differentiate between one age and the other. The Gemara says that there was a Talmid Chacham, a young rabbi who was very sharp, very learned, who taught Torah to his community, and he wasn't sincere about his religion in certain respects. He committed certain crimes. So the Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda studied this question, what should we do? Should we put him in Chedem? Because how does it fit for a Chacham like him to be doing these things? If you put him in Chedem, that means that nobody is allowed to come within 4 amot, 6 to 8 feet close to him. They cannot have any contact with him anymore. They will lose the knowledge that he could disseminate to them. Should we not put him in Chedem? It's a Chilul Hashem. He's disgracing the religion. So another rabbi answered, Yochanan said, there's a pasuk in the Torah which says that a leader who teaches Torah is supposed to be like a malach Hashem, an angel of Hashem. If this leader is like an angel of Hashem, then Torah yivakshumi pihu. They should go to him to study Torah from him. If he's not like an angel of Hashem, then stay away from him and find a different teacher. With this instruction, Rav Yehuda put this young rabbi in Chedem. Sometime later, Rav Yehuda became very ill, extremely ill, and he was lying on his deathbed. The rabbis came to visit him, pay their respects, and this young rabbi came along too. When he entered the room, Rav Yehuda saw him, he left. The young rabbi felt very badly. He said to him, not only isn't it enough that you put them, that you made the Shechedim, but you're also laughing at me? Rav Yehuda said, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing, I'm smiling, I'm happy about the fact that I'm about to pass away, and when I come to the heavenly court, I can stand there firmly and say, I did not kowtow, I did not bow, I did not flatter anybody. I have no consideration for any person at all. If it was a case of Kiddush Hashem. With this, Rabbi Yehuda passed away. Sometime later, this Chacham came to the Beit Midrash of Yehuda, and he said to them, "I plead with you, release me from that chirim." The rabbi said, "One as great as Rabbi Yehuda does not exist. The only one that can remove a chirim from a person is the person who made the chirim, or somebody equivalent to him in greatness. There's nobody here as great as Rabbi Yehuda." So he waited, he went to another big rabbi. The result was that they said, "We cannot remove a chedem placed upon you by one so great as Rabbi Yehuda." He walked out from this Beit Midrash. He was crying very bitterly. He felt very bad, very sad. When he walked out, a snake came along, bit him, he died. Now the question was, in burying him, they said, if he died, that's his kapara. They took his coffin, they brought it to the special cemetery of Hasidim. They tried to get in there, and they could not get him in. There was something blocking, if it was a serpent or some kind of an obstacle that did not allow his coffin to enter among the Hasidim. They took him to the grave of the rabbis. Rabbis means just rabbis, not Hasidim. Hasidim are much higher than rabbis. And here he was accepted. The Yehuda says this was the final kapara for him. Why was he not accepted among Hasidim, though he was great? Perhaps great enough, except for the certain things he had done wrong, because a chidim that's placed upon a person remains upon that person even after death, if it's not removed during his lifetime. Since he was in chidim after death too, then the chidim had to remain. He could not be buried among ones in a class of pure chasidim. The Yehuda says that why were they afraid to remove that chidim, actually? Their motive was, or their motivation was, the fact that Rabbeinu HaKadosh, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the chief rabbi of the Yehuda, had a maid. And this maid, just a maid now, the maid of Rabbeinu HaKadosh was so great and so learned that the Yehuda says many times the rabbis would come to her for information. In fact, the Gemara tells us that on the day that Rabbeinu HaKadosh became ill, he was about to pass away, then the rabbis got together and they said every single rabbi must be present, and with a combined effort, a combined powerful tefillah, powerful prayer, to save the life of Rabbeinu HaKadosh, that they should not be able to get him in heaven. And they prayed very hard. They put all their heart into it. The maid of Rabbeinu HaKadosh stood on the side and she watched. And she said, "Look at this battle going on between the heavenly court and the earthly court. The heavenly court is tugging from one side, trying to get the soul of Rabbeinu HaKadosh. And the earthly rabbis, these great rabbis of the Gemara, are all pulling from the other side. Well, I say, let the heavenly court win, in order that he be taken out of his suffering." He was suffering very much physically, that illness. With those words, he was nistelek, he passed away. So great was her power. Now, again, the Gemara tells us about the times the rabbis came to her to learn wisdom from her. There's no explanation in the Gemara as to the reason for this. What made this maid so great? There were rabbis who were holy. We're speaking about the rabbis of the Gemara, such great ones, holy ones. How could a maid be greater than these rabbis? The Rizal, Ari Kadosh, explains, he sheds light on this, and he says that who was this maid? We just mentioned the Gemara as a maid of Rabbeinu Kadosh. The Gemara tells us that when the Jews stood at the Red Sea and they sang the song of the sea, as Yashida Moshe B'nai Yisrael, Hashida Azot, song of praise to Hashem at the dividing of the waters of the Red Sea. The Gemara says that every one of the Jews there saw the Shekhinah. So great was that moment of holiness that the Jews were all zochet to see the Shekhinah. Even a child, even an unborn child, the Gemara says that an unborn child could see inside, in his mother's stomach, he could see through and see the Shekhinah. The Gemara says then that later on there was a Navi, Yechezkel the Navi, who relates that he saw a vision of the Merkava. That's the highest vision possible, describing the Merkava in heaven, the throne of Hashem, and how it's carried by certain special angels. This whole descriptive order of the vision of Yechezkel the Navi. And this is called Maaseh Merkava, where all the Kabbalah revolves around that vision of Yechezkel. So the Gemara says that an ordinary, every Jew at the Red Sea, even a maid, saw more, higher Kedusha than Yechezkel HaNavi saw in this vision of the Merkava. Rabbi Kadosh says, do you want to know the secret of the maid of Rabbeinu Kadosh? Why the Gemara says that she was so wise that the rabbis of the Gemara came to her for information. Why she was so powerful that with her prayer she could overrule the prayers of all the rabbis of the Gemara. When she made one statement and said, for this battle between heaven and earth, I say let heaven succeed against all the rabbis of the Gemara. And immediately she won. He was nistalek, Rabbeinu Kadosh. Because she was the Gilgul of that maid the Gemara speaks about. This maid who had seen the Shekhinah, this was the maid of Rabbeinu Kadosh. Now the Gemara says, what was their purpose? Why did they refuse to remove the Chedem from this Talmid Chacham? Because they said, if the maid of Rabbeinu Kadosh once put a person in Chedem, and nobody removed that Chedem, how can we remove the Chedem of our rabbi when he put a man in Chedem? The Gemara says, when did she put a man in Chedem? The Gemara says that she once saw a man striking his son, a grown son. When she saw that, she said, I declare this man in Chedem, because he's committing the sin of Lefnei Iver Lo Titen Mechshol. Do not place a stumbling block in front of a blind man. That means, do not cause a person to fall into a pit. He's blind. At the moment, he's blind. Don't do something, this doesn't mean by a really blind man. Blind is he who does not see or doesn't understand. If you give a person wrong instructions, wrong directions, that person is blind in this respect. You're misleading him. That's breaking the law of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind man. If you lead a person to sin, then you're causing that person to fall into a pit. So, breaking the law of putting a stumbling block in front of a blind man. So here, by striking a grown son, this means really hitting him hard, the son will lose himself, and he may strike back. And a son who hits a father, the penalty is automatically death. So he is causing, he's leading his son to the possibility of a death penalty. He'll make his son lose himself. A young child has no problem. But a grown son who is used to battling, hitting back, might lose himself, and therefore he is causing this possible stumbling block. Therefore he's to be put in chedem. This was the chedem that she used. And the Gemara, the question of course, why does this pasuk refer to striking a son only? Because a daughter is not the kind, there's no fear. A man, let's say, would strike his daughter, you haven't got this chedem for it. A daughter is not the kind who strikes back. A girl doesn't have that nature. So this applies only to striking a son. And the penalty for it, she said, was because he broke this sin. The power that was vested in her, she placed it in a chedem, and no rabbi dared to remove that chedem. Therefore, in this case, too, they said, we cannot remove the chirim of our rabbi who would put this chacham in the chirim. The Gemara goes further on this topic and says that the Resh Lakish, who was the biggest student of Rabbi Yochanan, was once working as a guard in a plant, not a plant, but a field. A man came in, a stranger, and he started to eat figs in that field. Resh Lakish was originally the head of a band of thieves, very powerful. He let out a roar to this man to stop stealing these figs. And the man refused. Actually, it was, the commentaries say, it was customary for a person in that city to walk into somebody else's field to eat and to pay for it later. Ordinarily, that's considered gezeilah, stealing. But where it's a custom, then it's permissible. But Resh Lakish was the guard there, so he told him to stop eating, and the man refused. Resh Lakish said, I put you in cheder. He was a student of Yochanan, he was a big rabbi already. The man retorted, on the contrary, I put you in cheder. And with that, the man got up and left. Resh Lakish, the man said to him, you, what do you, I owe you something? I owe you money, not cheder. Why put me in cheder? Collect money, don't put me in cheder, because you put me in cheder illegally, I put you in cheder, and goodbye. The man left. So Resh Lakish was worried. The man came out with a statement, I put you in cheder, there's a problem. So he came to his rabbi, and he said to him, he asked the rabbi, what's the rule here? Whose cheder took effect? What did both of them? The reply was, your cheder is void. It was done by error. His cheder is legal, and you are a cheder. So he said, what can I do? The only thing you can do, he said, is to go to this man and have him remove it. Beg him to remove it from you. So he said, I never saw the man in my life. There's no way I can ever find him again. It's impossible to locate him. So in that case, you have to go to the chief rabbi, who then we know surely is at least as great as him or greater, and only he can remove the cheder. This law we have, a person was put in cheder. He doesn't know who the one that put him in cheder is, if he has the power to do it, or how great he is, in case of doubt like that. The only solution is to go to the chief rabbi at the time of the generation. You know for sure, because the only one that can remove a cheder is either a person who put the cheder on, or one who is greater than him, equal to or greater than him. So in order to make certain, you go to the Nasi, the chief rabbi of the Jews at that time, and he can remove the cheder. So the Gemara says, let's get this clear once and for all. We speak about cheder and cheder. What is cheder? What's meant by this cheder? It's a type of a curse put upon a person. And of course, it's put upon a person by one who has authority. Not any person can misuse the word chedim. It's done by a chacham who has that authority, but what does he do? The Gemara says the word chedim, of course, is Hebrew. Aramaic, the Gemara word for it is shamta. Shamta is the Aramaic word for chedim. Shamta is the combination of two words, shin, mita, the title of death. This is like placing an aura of death around a person. It makes the person to be placed in the category of a corpse. There's no more contact with the living. Also, the Resh Lakish explained that why do we call it cheder? Because cheder means also destruction. But at the same time, we use that word cheder rather than churban, because cheder is chet resh mem is 248. There are 248 organs in a person's body, and this cheder penetrates into every single one of these 248 organs. Every part of that person becomes ostracized, banned from his community, from the Jews. Now, when the cheder is removed, what happens? The word is just turned around, even as it says, from cheder to rachem, the same three letters. Rachem means pity, kindness. And the whole evil destruction is removed, taken out, Once again, kindness rests upon this person. He is brought close back to the community. The Yemenite says this can apply to anything. Does this mean you put a person in Chedem only? This is definitely not. Chedem has such a power that at one time there was a case of the rabbis in the yeshiva had trouble. Somebody was destroying their shoes. Seemed to be destroying, eating their shoes or destroying it. They couldn't tell who it was, so they said, we place a chedem upon the thief, upon the one that caused the destruction. And they saw a dog nearby whose tail suddenly caught fire. The chedem had landed upon this dog, the guilty culprit, and so quickly did it act. Destruction caught this dog in its grasp, and the tail of the dog caught fire, and naturally this fire consumed the entire dog. This death of the chedem consumed the dog. So effective is this chedem. Well, the Yemenite teaches us a very important set of rules that applies to every person, and something that a person does regularly throughout life. He meant it says that Shmuel was the chief rabbi mentioned throughout the Haggadah. He had a brother whose name was Pinchas. One time, Pinchas had a death in his family, and he was sitting Shiva. And Shmuel came to visit him. He sat there to pay his respects during Shiva. He noticed that Pinchas' nails were very long. He hadn't cut them. So Shmuel said to Pinchas, why don't you cut your nails? You know that nails, all the tum'ah, all the evil spirits assemble and they accumulate and they adhere to the nails of a person. Nails and hair, two parts of a body where all the klipot, the tum'ah, the evil spirits stay, adhere to a person is long nails and long hair, except the pe'ot. The rest of the hair and the nails is where all the tum'ah accumulates. How come you have long nails? So Pinchas cried out, if you were an Abel, if you were mourning, would you consider your looks so carefully as to cut your nails? Well, with this, the Yemenite says that the person, not just a chacham, a tzaddik, every person must watch his tongue. Always watch your tongue, because if you let a word out of your mouth that's not carefully stated, the Satan has a right to grab those words and use it against you. This is what we say, tiftach peh l'satan. Don't open your mouth to the Satan. Don't say something which is suggestive. Say a person, if you were sick, if you had this illness or something, never let those words out of your mouth, because Satan can then say, you did it to yourself. He can take those words and bring it to reality. Immediately afterwards, Shmuel was in Abel. He was in Abel, he was sitting Shiva, and Pinchas came to visit him. Shmuel then went in front of him, cut his nails, took them and threw them at Pinchas's face, right into his face. And he said, don't you hold of the fact that a Brit is a treaty, power in the tongue of a person? By saying anything at all, you can make it come true. You will invite disaster by saying things. Especially a tzaddik who says things, the word comes out of his mouth, it comes true. We find this explicitly in the case of Abraham Avinu. He went with his son to the Akedah. In the Pasuk we find that when he reached the place of the Akedah, Abraham Avinu said to, he had with him his two boys, Yishmael and Eliezer. he said to them, the pasuk, it says, he told them, Shavu lachem po'im ha'chamor, you remain here with the mule. I and the boy, Yitzchak, are going further. We're going there to bow on the mountain, and then we'll return to you. He was going to sacrifice his son. He just said it to mislead them. We're going there, we'll return to you. Not I will return, we will return to you. But because the words came out of his mouth, there could be no changing that. It had to take effect. The words of his tzaddik came out and said, we will return. His son had to come back alive. So we see from there that a person should guard his words. And again, this doesn't refer only to a tzaddik. Especially, perhaps an ordinary person could not say a word of blessing and miracle that can come true. But a word of harm and tragedy that can come from anybody's mouth. Never say anything bad, because the satan will grasp that word and make it come true, bring it to reality. That's why Shmuel was so angry at Pinchas. How did you say to me, let the word out of your mouth if I was in Abel? The minute you said it, the satan had you. That's why your fault, you were a good aim, you caused my being in Abel. Now the Gemara says, let's go back to this topic and study it more carefully. The question of nails. What about nails itself? Shmuel was so particular about having Pinchas cut his nails. We know that it's a mitzvah to cut nails. A person should see that his nails should not grow long. Especially the best time to cut nails are Erev Shabbat, for the Kavod of Shabbat, to separate all the Tumah from a person, to be pure before going to the mikveh, before preparing for Shabbat. But the question now is, when a person does cut his nails, he has removed the tumah from his body. What does he do with these items of tumah if they are that tameh? The Gemara says that the ruling is there are three categories, three types of people. There's one who cuts his nails and he buries them, and that person is called a tzaddik. He buries them so that no person can ever make contact with this tumah. That's a tzaddik. There is one who is greater than a tzaddik. A chassid is greater than tzaddik. I'm quoting Gemara, not Kabbalah. A chassid is one who burns them. In other words, he ensures the fact that there'll never be a danger of these nails coming to light again. He completely destroys them. Burying them is like flushing them down the drain. Burning them means to make them disappear from the face of the earth. One who takes his nails carelessly, throws them out, he is a rasha, a complete rasha. So the Gemara says, when we say rasha, we mean really evil. Not just that rasha commits a sin against Hashem. Rasha is one who's even bad, evil against a person. Why is a person who throws away nails considered a rasha? The answer is, the Gemara says, because if these nails are any place where a pregnant woman will step on them, this can cause her to have a miscarriage. That's for sure. Pregnant woman steps on nails, this can bring about, in most cases, to a miscarriage. This is what the Gemara says, and of course the Zohar HaKadosh adds to this. This does not mean that only a pregnant woman can be harmed. Every person who steps on nails can be harmed. So any person who is careless or negligent with cutting of nails, where he lets them fall loosely, not all the nails, even one single nail, even a fraction, a tiny bit of a hangnail, to let it fall to the floor and ignore it, and somebody should come and step on it, that person is guilty of something tantamount to murder, or certainly causing physical harm to a person who will step on it. Therefore, he is called a rasha. That's why the people in particular, religious people, when they cut the nails, they see to it that they put up barriers all around it. No nail should pop out, fly off. This is where it cannot be found. They ensure against the loss of any drop of a nail. And then when they are finished, they wrap it up carefully and flush it so that there's no possibility of them being the cause of any person being harmed by their nails. One who does that, of course, is called a tzaddik, or even more, a chassid. There's one step above a chassid, of course, when you have the prefacing the word chassid. It's really lev basad, heart of soft heart, flesh. Lev basad, when you turn the letters around, it's breast love. I think that says that Paro, every Egyptian king was called Paro, but the one that lived in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, the one who had contact with Moshe Rabbeinu, the miracles were done, the 10 plagues, he was very short. He was a midget, about 2 feet tall. His beard, too, was 2 feet long. In other words, his beard trailed on the ground, because the beard didn't cover the top of his head. So that the beard being as long as his whole body, his beard trailed on the ground. And he had the evil that came to women as much as more than the tallest of men. This thematicus goes together. When a person, what's meant by him being so small and short, long beard, this refers to his ge'avah. His ge'avah was so great. The more ge'avah a person has, the lower he actually is. His ge'avah made him the lowest person in the world. And this brought about to evil desires in his part too, that this was one chunk of evil throughout. To an extent where he came out with a statement, he is so great that he asked me Hashem, who is Hashem? That's how, that's the extent of his gavah, how far it reached. We should be zocher to receive, mikabel, accept the words of the Torah and its advice, to learn it, to fulfill it completely, and that's we zocher to see the binyan bet mikdash. ביאת המשיח מהר ממנו, אמן ואמן. We continue the shiur in Gemara. The Gemara says that on Yom Tov, on holidays, it's a mitzvah to be besimcha. The mitzvah of the holiday is to be besimcha. The same thing holds true on Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days too, there's a mitzvah to be besimcha. Now, if a person makes some type of celebration on the Yom Tov, which is not part of the Yom Tov itself, that means this is going to interfere with the happiness of the holiday. Therefore, happy occasions are forbidden on the holiday, so we can concentrate purely on this and the holiday. For example, the law is that you're not allowed to have any weddings on Yom Tov, because we cannot mix two happy occasions. A person has a wedding and forget about the Simcha of Yom Tov and concentrate on the wedding. Now, the same thing would apply then to Chol HaMoed, immediate days. You're not supposed to mix these two happy occasions, therefore weddings should be forbidden on the holiday. Yet, on the Chol HaMoed. Yet, the Gemara says, Shmuel says, it is permissible for a person to get married on Chol HaMoed. Why so? Because if he delays, this means delaying for approximately a week, if he delays the wedding for a week, he is jeopardizing himself that someone else might rush quickly and take his zivug away from him. He postpones it, there might come someone else and take away his destined mate. The one he wants to marry, someone will come and take it away. That's how he will lose his mate. Therefore, it is permissible to get married on Chol HaMoed. This is a statement of Shmuel and the Gemara. Now, the Gemara asks questions about that, trying to refute this statement. First, we get general rules. We'll understand these general rules, then we'll understand what the Gemara says. The word zivug means a mate or a match for a person. The woman a man marries, that's his zivug, his mate. Now, the Gemara says that there's one statement which says that before a person is born, 40 days before a person is formed, before the body is formed, when is the child's body formed? When the child is, when the woman is 40 days pregnant. 40 days prior to that, which means that the day of conception, a voice in heaven announces that the daughter of this certain man is going to be the zivug, the mate of this child who is just conceived. Which means even before a child is born, it is already announced in heaven who will be the mate for this child. Second announcement is, this house will belong to this man. This field will belong to this man. These three items are announced when a child is first conceived.